Welcome back in Ion College Basketball Podcast for CBSSports.com. I'm your host, Matt Norlander. I hope you are doing well. The last benchmark of the college hoops regular season has finally passed. The Super Bowl has come and gone. So, you know, we like to say once college football regular season ends and the new year comes and conference season comes, people start drifting more and more to college hoops. And now with the Super Bowl over, the sport will take the main stage. A lot of good stuff over the weekend. You know, Air Force, we see what you're doing. Southern Miss and Belmont, a couple of good teams. Indiana-Michigan was a really good game. We got a lot to get to here, and perfect guest for this Monday edition is Seth Davis, of course, of Sports Illustrated. You see him on TV, CBS Sports, and CBS Sports Network, where you can catch Courtside with Seth Davis every Wednesday at 7 p.m. He's on Twitter, at Seth Davis Hoops. A good follow. He interacts well with his followers, and he's actually developing a little bit of a reputation of being a little crotchety this year, I think, Seth. How you doing, man? How are things going?
I'll take that as a compliment. And by the way, get off my lawn.
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, hey, you know, we got plenty to talk about here, but you have become anti-court storms. That's what people are giving you grief over. Everyone gives you grief over your rankings every single week, man. So, I guess this is your thing here. But you're not trying to do it or whatever. You kind of go against the grain with a few popular opinions.
Well, you know, it's interesting because everybody talks about. First of all, thank you for having me back on your podcast. You know, everybody talks about rankings in college basketball don't mean anything, and of course they don't. But I get by far the most response, let's just say, from I tweet out my AP ballot. I'm an AP voter, so I tweet that out right after I email it into the Associated Press on Sunday evenings. And then in my Monday Fast Break column, I have my ballot, and I show where I rank the teams the previous week, and then I just give a sort of explainer as to my rankings. And, you know, I have to say it's kind of funny because – even as I'm writing my explanations, I can see all of the holes in my logic. You know, I mean, it's just the nature of ranking, especially in February when there's so many results. So, you're weighing in injuries. You know, do I rank this team how they are without this player, or do I give them the benefit of the doubt because they were without this player? You know, you can make an argument anyway, but it definitely fires people up. It's quite an interesting phenomenon. Every Sunday night, I tweet that out. Even during the Super Bowl last night, it was a little bit tempered, but it was still pretty heated.
Yeah, no, fans they are so vested, and I totally get it. That was some sort of bizarre Super Bowl. You know, I was trying to picture if the lights had gone out at the Final Four. We were, of course, in New Orleans last year. How bizarre a scene that would have been. Let's hope that doesn't happen at the Final Four. I mean, as interesting as it is, it's also like ultra embarrassing, and I wonder if it prevents New Orleans from getting Super Bowls and Final Fours down the road, you know, man?
Well, I sure hope not. You know, it's my favorite city on the planet.
Yeah.
Home of the Radiators, greatest band in history. And, you know, it's just something that happened. I mean, it was, you know, we don't really know what happened. But, you know, to me, in my obviously non-expert viewpoint, you know, people were saying that it was a power outage. It looked to me like it was a surge. You know, like you have that in your house where, you know, you go down to the circuit breaker and just flip over the switch and then it comes back on. So I think it looked like there was some type of surge that knocked out half the arena. And then it just takes a long time for the lights, for everything to come back on.
Right.
It's just so much power. So that's – but, you know, I was actually thinking this morning, like, pretty lucky that only half the dome went dark.
Yeah. I mean,
can you imagine if the whole dome went out and the place went pitch black? I mean, that could have been a really – scary situation, and I have to say, our colleagues at CBS, I thought, handled it really well. I'm not going to lie. Obviously, I would never, ever, honestly, ever want that to happen at any time, especially the Final Four. But, you know, I was kind of thinking, well, you know, if that's at the Final Four, maybe I'll just call the game. You know, maybe everybody's microphone will be down except for mine, and that will be my time to sort of just call the Final Four. I mean, it's inevitable, so I might as well just get it over with.
Well, yeah, you are working your way toward that. You did some play-by-play last week, right? How'd that go, man?
Color. I did color.
That's what I meant. Yeah, color. You were on the call, and you were doing some color analysis. How was that? And how much did you prep for? I mean, did you alone in your house the weeks leading up to it, trying just as a game was happening live, whatever it was, do a little practice that way, or how did you prep?
No, well, this was the Dayton at Xavier game last Wednesday, CBS Sports Network. And the reason why I was there was because we did not do courtside last week because everybody was down in New Orleans. So, you know, I've done not a lot of color commentary on games, but I've done enough to know that I enjoy it. And I think I'm pretty good at it. I'd like to think so anyway. And so it's not, you know, and it's interesting that you asked the question you do, Matt, because, you know, I was down at the Battle for Atlantis and I did color commentary on Axis TV, which is the network owned by Mark Cuban. So we had, you know, the three daytime doubleheaders, including, you know, Duke, Minnesota that first day. And that was preparing for, you know, essentially eight teams. And there's a lot more work doing that, and it's harder because it's early in the year, so you don't really have much of a chance to see them play. But what I have found in the past is that I really enjoy the preparation for doing color. It's different than doing studio. It's different than going there and writing and just kind of getting your stuff. You really have to know these teams through and through. You know, I watched a lot of games on television, on the laptop. You know, I can download any game I need to, or go on Synergy and watch games. And, you know, I actually came in a day early and spent, so I went to Xavier's practice, and then I went over to the Dayton Hotel and sat with their coaches and watched them do some film work. I watched Xavier do some film work with their players. And, you know, it was a lot of fun. If you've done the preparation, you know, similar to writing, you know, the vast majority of the information and stats and nuggets that you've collected is not going to make it to the air, but it's just a good feeling, you know, having it there. And then, you know, the energy of an arena being courtside at an important, you know, maybe it wasn't a huge national game, but believe me, Dayton Xavier is a really big game to the people of that area. And the storyline was that Dayton had not won at Xavier since 1981.
Yeah.
So, and they darn, you know, they had a chance to tie it up with a three-pointer on the final possession that just rimmed out. So it was a lot of fun, and then hopefully I'll get to do more of it down the road.
Don't you get that you see the game in a different way? Because I did this in college. Actually, I did play-by-play in college at my little D3 school, and it was – and I know play-by-play and color are totally different, because with color you're kind of bouncing off whatever the play-by-play man lets you do and kind of opens up to you. But – I just remember calling games and following it in a totally different way than when I write. And even like I officiated games before I got full time writing gigs. When I was a ref on the court, I would even see it differently that way. It's just interesting when you get different perspectives, and from TV to being there to calling it, how games unfold and how you get this weird purview. Did you get the same sense when you were on the color call there?
Yeah, it definitely. I mean, it's a great way to put it, because when I was preparing for the Battle for Atlantis, one of the teams was VCU, and I was really watching that. I was really watching their pressure, and I was just looking for different things. Like, well, how come they trap on that one, but they don't trap at a different time? Like, well, that was it, you know, because as a writer, they play full court pressure. But now I'm looking, well, you know, who are they putting at the top? What's their formation? Where are they picking up? Are they trapping? Where are they trapping? And so then I get to Shaka Smart, and I'm asking them a whole different set of questions. So, you know, I like being on a three. I like being the third guy in a three-man booth, because, you know, obviously I didn't play at any high level. I didn't coach at any high level, so you know, I don't necessarily bring that set of experiences, but I do bring, you know, a different set of experiences, which I try to bring to the viewer. And part of it, Matt, is just, you know, I think I just explain things differently to a viewer than somebody who doesn't, you know, necessarily communicate professionally would do. So it's just to have, in this case, Steve Wolf, who ironically played for Xavier, played on the last team to lose to Dayton in Cincinnati, in fact, you know, to have a third guy. In the past, I've worked with Tim McCormick. And also, like, I really feel like as a color analyst, the last thing I ever want to do is over-talk the game. I'm sure we've all watched games, and you're just saying, well, the guy just shut up and let me watch. And I say to my friends, you know, whether at ESPN or wherever, you know, they ask me advice, or sometimes I give unsolicited advice, shockingly enough, is, hey, nobody ever turned off a game and said, I wish the announcers talked more. So however much you want to talk, talk 10% less. And to me, it's easier to execute that if it's a three-man booth.
Yeah, see, that's what I do on these podcasts. I let all the guests talk, and I try and shut my mouth, and that's why That's why it's doing okay. Big game from over the weekend. We won't waste any more time. Obviously, Indiana, Michigan, just an awesome game. I mean, listen, it was great for the sport to have these two really good teams play such an energetic, athletic, up-and-down game. Indiana holds court at home. I think no less of Michigan in their national title chances. I think no more of Indiana, and you had a good point in your column. You know, Indiana was the preseason number one. A lot of pressure on this team to win it all and minimally get to the Final Four. And over the past month or so, we've just had this sort of like, Indiana's kind of there. Cody Zeller's not playing like the best player in the country like he should be. And yet they'd only dropped to, number seven. And patience is such a vital thing in the grand scheme. But that, you know, patience doesn't maybe sell writing a column after a game or tweeting amid a flurry of action, you know. But it was so vital. And now we see just how talented and good Indiana is, and they never really took a big dip. This was just a lot of validation to what we expected them to be, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we're certainly nitpicking. You know, we're looking real closely. This is the preseason number one team. Cody Zeller came in as kind of the face of college basketball. And so, you know, a lot of it, you know, as I wrote, it's just kind of, you know, you do lose a little bit of perspective. It's the ultimate compliment to a team like Indiana when you do that. But, you know, I do think that they've had – you know, some issues. I mean, they have more talent than Butler. They lost that game. Mm-hmm. They lost at home to Wisconsin. So those were their two losses. Impressive win at home against Michigan State. Hadn't really seen them do it on the road. So it's just kind of a constant evaluation process. But I do think that what we're seeing is they're getting better. You know, and they're getting better in all the right ways. And when you look at somebody like Cody Zeller. And I wrote this in Twitter. It's like, you know, maybe we just need to stop talking about what he's not and start appreciating him for what he is. I mean, I was in Assembly Hall, you know, sitting right near the court and just watching him. It's like, that's a big dude now. He's a big boy. And he plays so hard every possession. He understands the game. He never, you know, his biggest strength, maybe his biggest weakness. He's not trying to take over a game. He's trying to blend in and be a good teammate. Something to be said for that. And by the way, as good as he is, he's really the second best player on the team right now because Oladipo is playing out of his mind. So, you know, how many teams can have somebody like Cody Zeller and at least make the argument that maybe he's the second best player on the team? I really felt, Matt, beginning of the preseason, if you go back to what I wrote that about them in the preseason, that the difference with them this year was going to be Yogi Ferrell. And to me, he is so impressive on so many levels. I think he's a high, high character kid. I think he's all about winning. He's all about effort. He sees the floor. He's unbelievably quick. He's unbelievably confident. I think he's a better shooter than he has shown. He made some shots on Saturday. I've been saying he needs to shoot more from three. I think Zeller needs to, you know, shoot a couple of long jumpers because I think he's capable of doing it. But, you know, Ferrell gets them easy baskets. And in a game like Saturday where, you know, it's really two very, very evenly matched teams – you can get two or three easy ones where the other team can't. That's going to be the difference on the scoreboard. And I think Yogi does that for him. And they, you know, they were at home. They needed to hold serve. So let's, I think it's March 9th, I want to say, they play in Ann Arbor. So let's lace them up again.
I know, exactly. It is March 10th, end of the season, last day of the regular season, March 10th, Sunday at Michigan. That'll be a good one right there on the precipice of all the conference tournaments. One more quick thing on that game. It's just the Michigan aspect of it. I still love the Wolverines. If you told me these two were playing for the national title tomorrow, I'm not sure who I would take. Both have 20-2 records, have been awesome. Michigan's got the best offense in the country right now, averaging nearly, you know, 1.25 points per possession. Burke's awesome. The talent is fantastic. What are your thoughts on Michigan and, you know, are they the better team still than Indiana? This was on Indiana's floor. What is your diagnosis on the Wolverines?
It's real close. It's real close. You know, being able to stand eyeball to eyeball with them and watch that game at a close vantage point. I mean, I know that Jordan Morgan is hurt right now. But, you know, Mitch McGarry gives them a very, very big presence on the interior. But that's kind of my question about Michigan is – you know, do they have the inside high-level play that you need to win a championship? You can win a lot of games in the tournament. You can get to the Final Four. But once you get to those last few games, those last two or three games, do you have the inside game? Because clearly the guards are there. I mean, that's without a question. But, you know, there are other teams that maybe don't have quite as good guards as they do, but have guards that are comparable. So that's kind of my question about Michigan. But, I mean, the guards are so good, you know, that when they're making shots, they're almost impossible to beat. So the question becomes, you know, if you run into a night where you're not making shots, which is invariably going to happen in the NCAA tournament, it's hard to win all six games just being a jump shooting team. You know, what's your plan B? You got to get to the foul line. You got to get some easy ones off your defense. And you got to throw it to the post and beat teams on the glass. So, you know, maybe, you know, their plan A might be better than everybody else's plan A, but their plan B and their plan C, I'm not sure, is as good as some other teams plan, like a Florida, where they defend. You know, Florida, you know, they're making shots, that's great, but they're going to defend you really, really well every time out. I'm not quite sure Michigan is there, but they're awfully close. They're awfully good.
Yeah, whereas Florida doesn't have someone like Burke or even Hardaway who can get streaky but maybe dangerous, Michigan doesn't have the overall well-roundedness of Florida. McGarry's good. He's actually a really great rebounder for what he is as a freshman. I think he's getting better. And I think Glenn Robinson is actually fairly underrated for what he brings. But I just love the fact that Michigan and Indiana are this good again. I think that's just fantastic for the sport.
It was really fun there, Sal. I felt very, very honored.
What was it? I mean, what was that atmosphere like, by the way? I mean, top five regular season atmosphere you've ever experienced, or maybe not quite that good?
Well, I mean, I'm lucky in the sense, you know, I don't get to as many games as I used to because of all my television work, Matt. But
is that a humble brag you just dropped on me, Seth?
But I guess so. Yeah. But it's not even, you know, the humble part. It's just a downside that I don't get to as many games as I used to. But you know, I'm very, very fortunate that when I do go, I usually kind of cherry pick. So I'll usually see a couple of really high level games in person every year. And yeah, I mean, it was right up there. I mean, anytime you're at a big game in a place like Assembly Hall, Allen Fieldhouse, Cameron Indoor Stadium, I actually early in the day caught the first half of the Rhode Island Butler game. I'd never been to a Butler game in Hinkle. I'd been to Hinkle and I've been to a Butler practice, but I'd never been to a game there. So it was kind of a cool day.
That is a good high quality day. Heck of a day for Tom Crean. Heck of a weekend. You know, he gets the win, then he goes down and enjoys the Super Bowl, and kind of a bittersweet thing because he's obviously married to Joni Harbaugh. And one Harbaugh wins, one Harbaugh loses, but good weekend for Tom Crean. Also a really good weekend for Travis Ford and Oklahoma State. This was a really fun game. Ford's expression afterward, I don't know if you caught it, Seth, but they win. They beat Kansas by 5 for the first time at Fog Allen since 89, like the second time in 50 years, their first top 50 road win since like 1958. And Travis Ford's expression, first of all, he's you can read his mouth. He goes, "Oh my God." He's like looking at his assistant coaches. He's got like this little kid, like, "I really did it. I really did it." It was a really cool moment for that program. And damn, do I love Marcus Smart. Might be my favorite player in college hoops now. I mean, he is so fantastic as a freshman. I can totally see him being the kind of player that if Oklahoma State got the right kind of draw, if they got the right draw, he could be that freshman that takes him to like an Elite Eight. I think he's been that good. And the team overall has really played so well that you've even forgot about the fact that LeBrian Nash is an NBA prospect who really has not even still tapped his potential since he's got there.
Well, it's easy to forget that LeBrian Nash is an NBA prospect because he plays a lot of forgettable basketball, to be honest. But, no, I mean, you know, this was just a great opportunity for Oklahoma State. And you're right about Marcus Smart. I mean, you could make a case that he's the best player in the country. You really could.
He is awesome.
He's that good, and he's doing it without really being a dead-eye shooter. He was 0 for 5 from 3. But, he got to the line to shoot 11 free throws. That's hard to do on the road. And by the way, they have nothing inside. I mean, they can't, you know, they got Phil Jurek in there, and they cannot throw it at all into the post. So everything is on the perimeter. Everything is jump shooting. Everything is off the bounce. And yet he's still getting 25. And Markel, you know, Brown is a phenomenal athlete. He got 28. So, you know, more power to him. You know, I actually think that the more interesting part of the equation, frankly, is Kansas. Because Bill Self has been saying for the last few weeks, you know, we're not that good. We're not playing well. Like, we're not as good as our record. You know, we've just, you know, as he put it to me for Q&A I did with him last week, you know, we've picked the right spots to play poorly and the right teams to play poorly against. So, you know, he obviously, you know, knew something that we didn't, which is nothing new. But they are not getting the quality of play they need from that point guard spot. That's the bottom line. So if they're not running, they're not jumping, they're not out in transition, they're not scoring off their defense, when they get into that half court, Elijah Johnson is killing them. And, you know, a lot of people, a lot of us, I'm sure, you know, yourself included, Matt, expected Johnson because, you know, he really didn't have a great year last year. But about the middle of February, he turned it on and he was playing off of Tyshawn Taylor. So you think, okay, Taylor's gone. Now Johnson's going to step in there, and he just hasn't done it. So that's, you know, I'm sure they're working on it. I'm sure they're going to fix it. They got Nadir Tharp coming off the bench as a backup point guard who in a lot of ways might be, you know, maybe that's the change that you make. You know, even though Johnson's a senior, maybe you got to make that change. But, you know, all congratulations to Travis and Oklahoma State. I ranked them on my ballot this week, and I suspect they'll be in the top 25, wouldn't you?
I would suspect that. Yeah, I think they're going to be fine for rankings. I think this also – I mean, I kind of put up a quick blog post after the game. This was actually the win. I don't know if Oklahoma State didn't make the tournament if Travis Ford would have lost his job, but I feel like this is the win that actually solidified that he will without a doubt be there next year, because I think they're going to make the tournament because of this, and he'll be fine. I thought it was just so huge. As for Kansas, yeah, the point guard's an interesting situation. Elijah Johnson frustrates KU fans. I get that. They'll be an interesting case because I think Kansas is going to be a one seed, and if the point guard play doesn't improve dramatically, I still am inclined to say, like, I still like Kansas as a Final Four / national title borderline favorite, but if they don't have that point guard play, you know, is the old saying going to come true that, you know, you need that strong play at the one in order to win? We'll see. I mean, they've got a lot around them. I wouldn't be surprised if they defied convention in that way. And again, Elijah Johnson's an older player, so maybe he kind of gets it together. You have got Miami. Moving on, you've got Miami number 4 in your rankings. That is some serious respect. You talk with Larinaga. Give me your thoughts on the Hurricanes as the 4th best team in the country. Kind of a team that no one, casual fans, this is going to be one of those teams. Every year you get a few of these, Seth. They're not aware of all that's happening in hoops. They're going to wake up. Miami's going to be like a number 3 seed. No one's going to believe in them. Why are you so high on the Canes?
Well, you know, first of all, I just have a hard – some of this is comparative, okay?
Right.
And I was very impressed with the way that Duke played last week, even though they struggled to beat Wake Forest. You know, I mean, they're starting to play well. They're starting to figure out how to play without Ryan Kelly. We frankly just don't know if Ryan Kelly is coming back. I mean, they keep pushing back the timetable. They were saying all during the game, you know, they hope he's back for the tournament. Well, now it's the tournament? Well, how do we get to the tournament? So you're talking about a senior with a broken foot and obviously they've struggled without him, but I was impressed with what they did. But I just, how do you rank Duke ahead of a Miami team that just beat them by 27 points? I mean, they didn't beat them by 3. I realized it was in Miami. They didn't beat, and this is where it's like with the rankings, you know, do you say to Duke, well, you cut them some slack because Ryan Kelly's not there? Or do you have to say, no, we got to rank Duke where they are without Ryan Kelly, because we don't know if he's coming back. I mean, we know that Lorenzo Brown's coming back to NC State. We know that Dominic Gardis is coming back to Oregon. You know, either Ryan Kelly's not coming back, but we certainly know he's not coming back for a while. So 2 weeks ago, Duke went down to Coral Gables and looked like a JV team. And then what was impressive to me, Matt, is it would be very natural. We've seen all these situations, which is why, you know, I go grumpy old men on this whole rushing the court thing, because we see teams – coaches, players, fans celebrate these great wins and then not show up for their next game. But what did Miami do? They went and they blitzed Florida State by 24. Mm-hmm. And then they go at Virginia Tech, which is not an easy thing to do. And they win that game. And then, you know, obviously they were fortunate to win on Saturday. State doesn't have Lorenzo Brown. So all these things that you're taking into effect. I just see, you know, is Miami the 4th best team in the country? You know, probably not. But you know, I mean, UCLA loses at home to USC, and, you know, Butler gets blitzed at St. Louis. So, you know, they're getting it done right now, Matt. That's the bottom line. They haven't lost since that Christmas tournament, and they embarrassed Duke. They're winning on the road. They're undefeated in the Atlantic Coast Conference. And, you know, that this is one of those things where my subjective opinion of their – and I happen to think they're very good, partly because they're old. You know, 5 of their top 7 guys are seniors. Another one is a junior. And the sophomore, Shane Larkin, who's probably their best and most talented player. And they're getting it done. So, You know, I mean, if when they lose, I'll bump them down, and when other teams win, I'll move them up. But I at some point, man, I got to let results dictate my vote here.
Hey, I dig you, man. You said it. They haven't lost since Christmas Day. 8-0. They've got a 2-game lead in the ACC. Parrish is going to be at their home game on Saturday versus North Carolina. If they beat BC at home Tuesday, and then they beat Carolina at home Saturday, which they totally can do. If they're at 10-0 at that point, I'm going to say they will win the ACC. Which, hey, I mean, give Larinaga all the credit because he took the job. I was one of many who was like, you know, he's taking the job. He'll probably enjoy it for 5 years. Miami will be a non-factor, and that's fine. Larinaga's legacy is what it is. He took Mason to a Final Four. The dude has the program rolling. What did he say to you when you spoke to him last week?
Well, you know what? The more interesting conversation I had with him was – it was back in December, and I was going to the CBS Sports Network. We had their game at Central Florida. So I'm looking at their schedule on my computer there, December 18th, and I just wanted his insights on the team. I hadn't talked to him in a while to prepare for halftimes, and so towards the end of the conversation, I said to him, "Are you enjoying it? Like you like coaching at Miami?" And he laughed. He said, "You know, everybody asked me that question. The answer is the same here as it was at George Mason, as it was everywhere that I've been. When we're winning, I'm happy." And for a guy who's, I want to say 64 now, to give me that kind of an answer, I thought was very endearing and also very telling. I mean, he still loves what he does. He's still very passionate about what he does. And he's been around. This ain't his first rodeo now. I mean, He's been doing this a long time. He's always been a highly respected coach. Yes, you know, he's coaching mostly Frank Haith's players. He actually kind of told me the story about Shane Larkin. He recruited Shane Larkin to George Mason, but couldn't quite get him. And Shane Larkin went to DePaul. And then Larinaga got the Miami job. And Shane Larkin actually showed up on campus in DePaul and just instantly felt like he was too far from home. Larinaga gets the Miami job. DePaul, God bless their hearts, lets him out. And they somehow he Larinaga had to go to Donna Shalala and because it was the day before school was starting.
Wow.
So we brought in Dr. Shalala on that one. So it's just a neat situation, and I think they're here to stay because not only are they talented, but like I said, they're an old veteran team. These players that he's coaching, man, have never played in the NCAA tournament. They are taking nothing for granted, and the way that they handled the success of that Duke game was exponentially more impressive to me than the fact that they beat Duke the way that they did.
I hear you, man. And you make some really good points there. I'm looking forward to seeing how Miami plays the rest of the season. And if they get that 3 seed, or maybe they just continue just to romp and they win the ACC tournament, maybe they get a 2.
By the way, their non-conference strength of schedule in the RPI, I think it might be like 4th.
Yeah.
And overall strength of schedule is number 1. Duke is number 2.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're racking up these wins against weak teams. They played a really, really tough schedule. They played Arizona and Indiana State. They beat Michigan State, by the way, let's remember, back in November. So if right now they'd probably be looking at a 2 seed, I would think.
Yeah, and if they get it, I want to see how they handle that, because once you get to the tournament, when you haven't been there, different game. We'll see what they can do there. Now, this next question, I've been wanting to ask you this for a good month or so. What are your thoughts on the Mountain West? I mean, you only have New Mexico in your top 25. Colorado State's an awesome team, 18-4, great, the best power numbers across the board of any Mountain West team, but you don't have them ranked. Air Force, San Diego State, UNLV, Boise State, they're all kind of a mix. Wyoming's falling off a cliff, I get that. But are you with me in thinking the Mountain West is actually like a top 3, top 4 league, or do you think that might be a little overrated and that's why you're only giving the Lobos love?
You know what? It's honestly getting a little hard to say. If you'd asked me that question 2 weeks ago, I would have said no question. But, you know, it's just sometimes – it's the way the dominoes fall, you know? I mean, in some leagues, when there are a lot of good teams, you know, teams can help each other by playing each other. You know, you feel like on some level that's going on, you know, with the Big Ten. Maybe not quite in for example, Minnesota and Illinois. But,
yeah.
You know, in the Mountain West, it just feels like the way these dominoes are falling, it's not helping them. I mean, a great example is San Diego State. You know, I mean, they're a good team, but, you know, they lose at home to UNLV. And then they compound it by losing at Wyoming. So you say, well, you know, and then they lose at Air Force. last week. So then you say, well, you know, Wyoming is really good, but you know, Wyoming is falling off a cliff. They've lost, I want to say what, 6 of the last 8. I'm looking at their schedule right now. They've lost 6 of the last 8. So, you know, at a certain point, it's almost like they could use some separation. So when Steve Alford made his little kvetch about not enough Mountain West teams being ranked, I actually agreed with him and said so in a couple of different places. I had New Mexico, UNLV, and San Diego State ranked. But, you know, at some point when these teams, you know, keep losing, I mean, you can't tell me that if you're a borderline top 25 team and you're trying to make some hay and you're going to lose that Air Force. I know it's hard to win in your league on the road, but, you know, Air Force is not exactly the 86 Celtics. You know, at some point, you got to get the win. So come tournament time, you know, we'll see what the matchups are. I think the sleeper in there, by the way, is Colorado State. That's another all senior starting lineup with Larry Eustace. So, you know, it's a good, solid league. I think it's better than the SEC. It's probably, I would say, as good as the ACC. Maybe not quite as good as the ACC now, but, you know, it's a good, solid league. And I think, you know, once that tournament starts, I'm not a big league guy, like, oh, you know, 4 Big East teams lost in the first round. That means the Big East is overrated. No, it means they lost to the teams that they played. So I think there are a lot of good teams in that league. And I still think they're going to get at least 4 into the tournament. If I had to guess right now, I would say 4 teams are going to get in.
I will say 5.
Boise State being the bubble team.
Correct.
Boise State's got to win at Creighton. That's a great – that's, you know, for a bubble team, when you're being compared to other bubble teams and you're in that committee room and you're just trying to look for anything to hang your hat on, that's a great hang-your-hat win.
The Creighton win is huge. Air Force is not – listen, Air Force is 5-2, but their non-con is awful. They don't have any good wins. If Air Force, for some reason, if they end up getting 11 league wins, they're going to be a really interesting case because their non-con is just so bad. And then with how the Mountain West is sort of eating itself – I don't know if I'll see them as a tournament team or not, but they're going to have good wins. It's just going to be – it'll be a little freaky. And then Colorado State's 18-4 start is the best in program history. They're certainly worthy. I'll say 5 right now, but if it was 4, I wouldn't be surprised. I would wager that minimally they're getting 4, though. I think
– yes, I agree with you there.
The way that shakes out. Anything – you know, I like to sometimes open the floor up to the guests. Is there anything that you've got on your mind that you might be writing or musing about that you'd like to address here, Seth?
Well, it's a theme, and I'm gonna address it on courtside this week. So I'll give you a preview, and I wrote it last week too. I just really think we need to maybe step back and look at a macro picture at the way our game is being played and the way that our game is being officiated. You and people like Luke Wynn, a lot of people who are much smarter with these numbers than I am, have done a very good job illustrating the decline of offense. And, you know, I'm all for toughness. I'm all for defense. But I just think that some of these games, that, you know, the scoring is so low, and overall the scoring is down. And you can't just blame it on the AU scene. You just can't. You know, I realize that's part of it. And I realize, you know, when you lose your best players to the NBA, you're obviously losing your best scorers. But at a certain point, I think we need to start talking about the 30-second shot clock. Mm-hmm. And we need to start talking about cleaning up the physical play. I would bet even people listening to this podcast who are obviously huge basketball fans, if we did a poll right now and said to them, which game is more physical? Which game is there more contact? College basketball or the pros? I'll bet you 80% would say the pros. And it's not true. You talk to any NBA scout, these are guys who spend their lives traveling to college games, sitting courtside, and obviously watch a lot of NBA games, you know, up, they will all tell you that college is way more physical. That Dayton Xavier game that I did sitting courtside, it was a mugging, you know, and the NBA several years ago got rid of hand checking on the dribbler. And that cleaned up a lot, and they've really – now it's easier for the NBA to do this because they have full-time officials that work for the league that they can monitor and correct, whereas in college basketball, every ref is an independent contractor. They work for multiple leagues, so it's a little harder. But, you know, the 30-second shot clock to me, Matt, is kind of an interesting – I'd actually like to hear your thoughts on it because my thinking is, well, people will say, you know, it punishes defensive teams, but that is not true. The whole point of playing defense, half-court defense – is to force the offensive team into a late shot clock situation. So that shot clock is actually an extra defender. If you move it from 35 to 30, and remember when it was first put in place, it was at 45 and they moved it to 35. If you move it to 35 to 30, number one, it helps the defense. And I think there's a big difference between playing good, tough, hard-nosed defense, which I'm all in favor of, and just holding the ball for a long time to keep possessions low and keep score low. That to me is not defense. So I'm not 10 toes in, you know, fully on board with these two ideas, but I would like to see there be more discussion about them.
It's funny. You bring up stuff. Billis hit on a few of these things on Friday's podcast. So if you get
whatever he said, I agree with.
If you get a chance to listen to it, you're going to be
He's been very big about the physical play.
He's
been a real leader about that. And I echo every single thing that he has said on that subject. I'm in 100% agreement on.
And if you're listening to today's podcast and you missed the Friday podcast with Billis, go back and listen, because I ask, you said that college is more physical than the NBA. You've got time here. Explain to everyone why you believe this. And you laid it out, and he lays it out very thoroughly on that. So be sure to listen to that. I could do a whole podcast on offense in college basketball. But, yes, I do want a 30-second shot clock. I do think we are going to a 30-second shot clock. I think it's 4 or 5 years away still, but I think it's going to happen. And I do believe that coaches in general are very aware of what's happening here. They know that what's happening in these scores. I mean, when I do night court, I got to go through and I got to look at every game that's played that night. I got to recap to make sure I catch every little thing. And every time I do it, I will point out every time a team does not. I'll count the games where teams don't score 50. And sometimes there have been nights this season where we've had 8 or 9 teams that have not cracked 4T. There is no excuse for a Division I basketball team to not score as many points as there are minutes in a game. It's absolutely ridiculous. I do think there will be changes coming with the shot clock. The officiating is a much tougher thing to wield. Okay, I think that they will try and make some adjustments. But yeah, and I'm working on a story here on offense coming maybe closer to the tournament. But it is frustrating because the game is so fun and I love it. But critics of college hoops, they can just point to this year, and you can see the offense and how, not, I don't want to say it's bad, but it's slow, it's stagnant, the fouling is too much, it just doesn't make it as enjoyable of a cosmetic product as it was when, by the way, Seth, the shot clock was 45 seconds, and teams were averaging 77 possessions a game and scoring in the 80s and 90s.
Right. It's just that the philosophy has advanced, and, you know, there's a lot more pressure on coaches, and it's a much more controlling culture. That's why I'm trying to get rid of timeouts.
That's
a big peeve of mine. You know, you get to the end of the game and every time they come down the court, the coach calls timeout to draw a play. And I'm like, first of all, whatever you draw, half the time it's going to break down. They're not going to do what's on your clipboard. And second of all, what are you spending all your time on in practice?
Yeah.
Like, they're supposed to know what to do in that situation. And I'm just, see, now you're bringing out the crotchety old man in me.
No, I'm with you.
Although I have to say, Matt, you went crotchety old man on that four-court idea in Texas. I couldn't believe you were so against that. I'm like, what kind of old man is he? That would have been awesome.
Oh, come on, man.
Hey, would you have wanted to be there?
No, I would not have.
Please.
No. Hold on. Would I have wanted to be there if it was a one-time thing? I said I could have been there. Yeah, I just don't think it would.
You would have watched. You would have watched and you would have been there, and it would, and they're like, what? Because the ball, that'd have been awesome if the ball rolls on the court and the ref has to stop it. Because a ball run, that'd be the best thing ever.
I don't see how that would have been feasible when you've got all these horns, substitution horns. I just thought, and then you'd have this weird crowd dynamic.
You know what Mark Hollis's comparison was? He's like, it's like at the Masters. You know, one guy's on the tee and there's a big, you know, roar at the green behind him. I mean, that's good stuff, man. Come on. You're fine with people rushing the court and trampling each other.
No, hey, listen, I just gave up on commenting on fans running the floor and this is when you should do it, when you shouldn't do it, because at like around like 07 or 08, it just got like so ridiculous. I was like, this is just ultimately if someone's going to like get paralyzed and then they're going to end it, okay? Which is why you've got a point when you get ticked about these people running on the floor.
It's inevitable. Someone's going to get badly hurt. Or there's going to be a fight because, you know, player's going off the court. He's pissed because he just lost.
Yeah.
And he's got some loudmouth fan in his face, and he's gonna slug him, and he's gonna have every right to do that.
Yeah, it will inevitably happen. But at this point, when you just like you've no doubt witnessed it, when you want to say, you know, why you're rushing the court here and not there, fans just give you grief. So I'm like, all right, whatever.
You're right.
I'll just abstain from that. All right, man.
You're right.
I appreciate you coming back on. You can follow Seth on Twitter at Seth Davis Hoops. Read him on SI.com. Catch him on TV and courtside every Wednesday night at 7. This was great, man. Hey, listen, I look forward to crossing paths at some point here, inevitably, before the season is out. But until then, keep on doing a great job, buddy.
Too bad. I appreciate you having me.
No problem at all. Thank you again for listening. You can subscribe in iTunes. Feel free to tweet at me, at Matt Norlander. If you want to email me anything, appreciate the correspondence, hate mail, whatever you'd like. Matt.Norlander at CBSInteractive.com. The Wednesday show will be back with Goodman and Parrish. Look forward to that. Those guys also did TV work over the weekend, so we'll dive plenty into that. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you then.